It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense, another fine Saturday here in Wisconsin. I'm joined once again by my good friend and colleague, Attorney John Birdsall. How are you today, John?
I'm doing great, Kirk. How are you?
Doing all right. How's the weather in Milwaukee?
You know what? Same as it is in Sheboygan, but
really?
it's pretty nice though. I mean, we had a pretty decent week this week, you know? Pretty good run.
All right.
It's about time. It's about time, I would say.
It was one of those weeks where I wish I had the time to go out and play some golf or something.
Right.
But it never happened. I was just busy as can be.
No, I was buried. Just buried.
Buried. Well, I'm sure you heard the Donald earlier this week announced his dream list of potential people he's considering for. Yeah, he's already, let's put it this way, he's already changing the curtains in the White House. That's what he's doing, basically.
Taking measurements. Yeah, he's in on it. Yeah. Good.
He's got a list of would-be Supreme Court justices. And, I mean, this is an obvious ploy to try and appeal to the ultra-conservatives. And,
you know,
he had somebody do some homework for him. And interestingly enough, our very own
Diane Sykes
appears on the list. That's what caught a lot of local attention. But
who you and I are well familiar with.
Yes, absolutely. But another person who has had a very quick ascendancy along the judgeship ladder, I would say, and currently a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals judge, but has she was a Bush appointee, and it was considered very possible that when an opening came up, if an opening had come up at the right time during the Bush administration, that she would have been a favorite. So that'll be interesting if one of our own ends up on the court. Obviously designed to be I think this is trying to demonstrate that some thought goes into some of his policy matters. And I don't know that he actually put any thought into it at all.
I know he's trying to build that perception.
I understand that.
But, well, you know, let's talk about Diane Sykes a little bit. you know, I've had many, many encounters with her when she was a lowly circuit court judge in Milwaukee County. I say lowly facetiously. It's nothing wrong with that job, but she, you know, she's, as you say, had a very quick trajectory into the stratospheric heights of the courts of appeals, and really, I always saw her as deeply, deeply ambitious. She's a very nice person, and she's also very smart. I mean, this has been my observation of her. Whether you like the way she rules against you or for you or whatever or not, you know.
Well, when has she ever ruled for you? Because she's never ruled for me. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, you know, I know this is strange territory for you, but just assume it could happen. So anyways, what I observed, and she's not the only one that was kind of guilty of this, but that in the 90s, when the war on drugs was really sort of ramping up, like in major way, and we were building prisons. I mean, Tommy Thompson was building prisons like a drunken sailor on leave, spending money to build prisons. I mean, it was unbelievable. We were quadrupling our prison space. And that's when Sykes came on to the bench. And what I observed, her along with many, many others, she's not the only one, but many, many others that would, like, it seemed to me, purposely give huge sentences to, you know, just basic drug dealers or, you know, people who were in, you know, drug conspiracies or whatever, you know. And they were just like enormously outsized sentences that seemed to have no legitimate purpose or no basis in reality or evidence that this is going to somehow help our drug problem. And the thing that bothered me about that was it sort of like was you were picking on a defenseless population, a lot of young black men who you knew you didn't really have to worry about in terms of they weren't going to they weren't going to rally support against you politically. You were still going to be able to run and be a judge, and you were only going to get good headlines for being tough on crime, especially at that time. And so people were building their careers on the backs of these young men and on the train of the war on drugs. And that always bothered me.
You know, I think some of our listeners might have a little difficulty understanding where we're coming from when we talk about that mentality and what's wrong with it, because it has an obvious appeal to people that might be unfamiliar with the mechanics of the criminal justice system and policy considerations that we are now living with years and years later. Because I think a lot of people that don't have a lot of exposure to the criminal justice system and just think, well, for those that do bad things, they get what's coming to them, and what's wrong with throwing some drug dealers in prison for a very long time? They should have known they had it coming. And then it also sends a message out into that community that for the rest of you drug dealers out there, you better stop what you're doing. I mean, that's kind of one of those simplistic arguments that you hear. In fact, you know, that's the design. That's the purpose of that type of sentence, is to appeal to somebody that has a very cursory understanding of the system. The problem with all of that from a policy standpoint is that, you know, the legislature sets different priorities in terms of what are the most serious crimes and what are not as serious crimes. And they do that by setting maximum penalties. They also adjust, in some ways, sentencing factors that should be used. There's been attempts to implement guidelines in our state, but they haven't been fully successful ever. But the point is, if you politically have a desire to send a strong statement to the drug-dealing community, whatever you think that is, by giving these outrageously high sentences, what you're really doing is you are treating people that, frankly, need rehabilitation and need economic and educational resources in their community as though they're committing more serious crimes than they really are. And you're giving sentences that should be reserved for rapists and murderers. That's what you're doing. You know, by scoring political points on something that the community sees as a big problem in their own eyes because it's an obvious thing. It's something that people are scared of, you know, the drug problem. And we got all hyped up on it from the, you know, from the president right on down. You know, it trickled down to all of us where we were all, you know, felt that we were fighting the war on drugs by being suspicious of our neighbors, you know.
Right.
Remember those days? What are they doing? Why are their shades always closed? Must be drug dealers.
What does that remind you of? It reminds me of Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia.
Well, it also reminds me of when we had the House Un-American Activities Committee looking at
excellent
everything
point.
Everybody did because
right.
they were pinkos, you know,
right.
that kind of
right.
thing. But
yeah,
anyway, it's a complex argument. And what I'm really saying here is that in the universe of criminal laws, there are very serious crimes that warrant very serious punishments. And there's a scale that goes down. I mean, the crimes that involve heartless, inhumane cruelty and violence, you know, those people need to be removed from society. The people that are living in a community that is, you know, deprived, underrepresented, and people have to resort to illegal activity in order to make ends meet. And you and I have both represented many people that unfortunately find themselves in that situation as a matter of birthright sometimes. I mean, it's
right.
really a problem in
right.
some communities.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I've had
point.
People as clients that whose parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts and uncles, and the dog even, were all drug dealers because that's the life the person was born into. And, you know, sure, I suppose somebody could have had the wherewithal to extricate himself or herself from that environment and, you know, run away from home and join the circus and then find a private school to get a scholarship to. But the reality is that doesn't happen very often. And there's been we wonder why there's been such racial and economic disparity in these types of sentences. Well, the problem is that it's that these types of laws, especially when we had those crack cocaine enhancements that really disparately treated different communities, because as it turned out, that was a type of commodity that was more bought and sold in African-American communities. I mean, that's just how it happened to have worked. But we were all led to believe that it was that much more dangerous and so on and so forth. But, you know, now that heroin is not a drug problem that's race-specific, you know, it's interesting. We don't have the same sort of let's throw them all in prison forever and ever because they get caught with heroin. I mean, well, I hope we don't go back.
Well,
to that
heroin,
we've got to do more than just have a harsh reaction to it.
You know, the interesting part is how upset people get when a bunch of white kids die using heroin.
Yeah,
that's when the outrage
what's been
comes.
Happening.
That's. I mean, I knew some people personally up in Whitefish Bay, which is true to its name, very white. You know, so. Anyways.
Well, they call it White People Bay?
White Folks Bay, yeah.
White Folks Bay, that's it. Yeah. Okay. All right, well, we got to take a break, and we'll be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Hey, John, I wanted to talk a little bit about an editorial that was in response to a weekly column that attorney Tony Cotton, whom you and I both know, he's out of Waukesha, but very, very prevalent in Milwaukee as well, I would say. He writes a regular column for the Wisconsin Law Journal, and during the last issue, it actually would have been the one, I think, last week, not this week's issue, he had an interesting point about the fact that Brad Schimmel, the Attorney General of Wisconsin, is asking for a pretty massive increase in funding to hire more prosecutors throughout the state. Now, this is born out of a long history of different counties really wanting more funding. It's natural. Different government agencies always want more funding to work with. And having been involved in a government job for a very long time in my life when I was in the Air Force, I'm very used to how that concept works. You have to do more with less all the time. And when you're trying to do better at whatever you're trying to do, one of the things that we always look towards is how can we develop some funding to increase manpower, increase resources, increase our facility capacity. Just about every county that exists in the state has a gripe with not having enough judges to cover cases. And naturally, the DAs in virtually every county have a similar gripe that they don't have enough personnel. The DA in Sheboygan County, as a matter of fact, has repeatedly stated that if he doesn't get more funding...
Joe.
And if he doesn't get more funding, get more personnel, he's just going to have to start declining prosecution, almost like a, well, is it a threat? It might be a threat. I don't know.
Well, he said that explicitly, that, especially about, I think, marijuana possession. He was going to charge that.
Considering the fact that, you know, the federal government has already issued a policy statement to all FBI and DEA agents that it should be the lowest on the priority of resource spending, there wouldn't be anything really wrong with passing on some of those cases, you know. But I can tell you, I still see a plethora of cases that I think should never have been charged, that discretion could have been exercised differently. Hey, but that's the nature of discretion. People are going to disagree. However, discretion's exercised. That's what discretion is, you know. It means that it's decision-making, you know. But anyway, the point of the Schimmel press release that came out a few weeks ago was that we're in a state of emergency because we need more prosecutors and crimes are becoming more sophisticated, complicated, et cetera, et cetera. And Tony simply pointed out that, well, you know, it's ironic that you say that because
violence has gone way down.
Well, violent crime has gone way down. And, you know, we're not saying – crime itself hasn't become more sophisticated. It's just that we have cell phones and video in nearly every case now. And that's been the big revolution. But you know what that does? It actually makes it easier for prosecutors because, you know, it's just evidence. It is what it is, you know? Well, and I don't know how that makes it – it should make it easier, you
well,
know,
here's,
to prosecute
here's,
cases.
Here's
more objective.
Here's a couple of interesting facts. In 1998, there was 129,932 cases filed. In 2015, 112,014, which means a decrease of, I can't do the math exactly, but about 17,000 cases. And yeah. And we're spending like $1.25 billion per year on the Department of Corrections. That's obscene. It's the highest. It's the single biggest ticket item in the state budget. Bigger than building roads. Bigger than schools.
That's the bed that was made when truth and sentencing was passed.
I know.
Now we got to sleep in
it. I'm well familiar with the truth and sentencing debacle that occurred in the late 90s. So the point is that I understand that every player in the criminal justice system wants more power, and prosecutors want more power. They want more money. They want more personnel. They want to increase their market share, if you will, of, you know, control over the system. But, you know, I think Tony pointed out correctly that, people have constitutional rights. They have a right to effective assistance of counsel. So that means that if we're going to increase filings, if that's the path you want to take us down, then we're going to have to increase the public defender's office. And
that was really his point, is that whatever figure you've got in your head, you better double it. Because if you, for every prosecutor you add, you're going to have another public defender. I mean, you can't do it any other way. There isn't any other way that the economics balance out.
And I know you're going to find this shocking, but a lot of people don't agree with that. They don't think people should have a right to a lawyer.
but whether they agree with it or not, that's the law.
I understand that's the law, and you know, I'm happy that that's the law. But I'm just saying that politically speaking, I see the flag he's trying to hoist here. You know, which is the tough on crime thing.
So, point is this. There was this letter to the editor response. And I don't remember the dude's name now, but I know he works at one of those big law firms, like where, you know, nine floors packed full of lawyers, you know. Hey, I heard a funny joke the other day. you know what's wrong with – the thing about lawyers is that 98% of them give the rest of them a bad name. So I heard that from a neighbor down the street.
I'm going to have to remember that one. You know what? Yeah, I think it's better if we tell the lawyer jokes.
Yeah,
I think it kind of takes the wind out of the sails of the people that are really trying to rip on lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe you and I are part of the 2%.
So I think we totally, can totally, totally
in that realm. But anyway, let me. This guy writes a letter to the editor response, and I was shocked only because the person's a lawyer, you know, and it would appear that. Someone that understands the issue and understands what the point of the article was wouldn't have a knee-jerk, puerile sort of snotty reaction to the article, which is exactly what he did.
Well, he was like some big corporate type, right?
Yeah.
Well,
he's like, wait, if it makes my community safe, I'll be glad to have those tax dollars going towards it.
It doesn't. Duh. You don't have to be like, you know, Bubba from down south. You can be a high-priced corporate lawyer and still have those exact same attitudes. I know lots of them. You know,
he said, well, he goes, of course Cotton would be in support of scaling back on government spending because he's a defense lawyer. He wants to have easy pickings and overwhelm the prosecutors. Something like that. I mean, it was just, please, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
But
trying to paint the prosecutors as overwhelmed, I think, is just hilarious.
Yeah. I'm sure they feel overwhelmed, but you could double the number of prosecutors. They'd still feel overwhelmed. I just think they would, don't you? But anyway, that's a perception issue. And, I think we all feel overwhelmed all the time. It's part of American society. It's, you know, compared to like what they do in Spain where they take siestas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was just saying this to my wife the other day. We should really promote the idea that we should call weekdays weekends and weekends weekdays. And then that way we could have a 2-day work week and a 5-day weekend. That would be way better, you know, if we could somehow work that out.
You know, I like your thinking, buddy.
I think that, you know, it's really a function of, you know, American mentality. We work hard. We work a lot. We're all addicted to work. I mean, shoot, man. I mean, I enjoy my work. I absolutely do. But I work very late, and I work all weekend. I spend more time in jail than most of my clients ever have to, you know, just because I'm there visiting people. And I think that's part of people get you add some politics into all of that, like someone that has to get reelected every term, that being the DA's office in any given county. There's a lot of pressure to be able to generate the numbers, to be able to say you're doing a good job, to have the bragging rights, to say that you kept the county safe. But I don't see any evidence anywhere of prosecutors turning their backs on potential prosecutions. I mean, you know how many cases get charged out where it's a 17-year-old boy versus a 15.9-year-old girl? I mean, those are cases that don't need to be charged out. But the philosophy that I hear in many DA's offices is, hey, the legislature made it a felony, so we're just following the law. And they charge, you know, basically every kid in high school that gets caught doing what every kid in high school does.
Don't even get me started on that, Kirk.
Yeah. I'm not going to say every kid, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. I know exactly what you're saying.
This is something that I think most adults that are over the age of, you know, 40 can – I mean, it's just shocking.
Dude, you know, when I was a teenager, I was a hellion, and I had more than a couple of run-ins with the police, and what they did was appropriate. They took me home, or they called my dad, who I was far more scared of.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a cop out to say, hey, the legislature made this law.
Yeah,
they made it a felony.
Out.
I can't change it. So
you're supposed to exercise
discretion.
They're not
turning their backs on those cases. They're not exercising discretion to pass up on those things. They're charging every one of them they can.
That's the reason
the Romeo Juliet cases.
That's the reason
bread
the Supreme Court has come time and again talking about the wide prosecutorial discretion that exists and how they have the right to exercise it, you know? And, well, you know, they can't have it both ways.
Right. We got to take a break, but we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. You know, right before the break, we were talking about this issue of funding for the state. I just wanted to follow up on one final aspect of that, and you alluded to it before, John, but traditionally it's very hard for people to understand the need for funding of the public defender's office. And one thing that I thought was rather interesting about this whole debate is that the point was made, and I think it's a very good point, that the DA's office does have, I'm not going to say unlimited resources, but they have access to virtually all of the public resources that our tax dollars pay for by creating, you know, police forces, the equipment they have, the surveillance equipment, the guns, the dogs, the badges, all that stuff. You know, that's part of that machinery. And the public defender's office is really, they may have, you know, like they may be able to get a private investigator to do some side work, you know, something small amount of participation. But otherwise, it just comes down to sheer willpower, sweat, you know? That's the thankless part of somebody who works for the public defender's office, is that they're thrown into this situation where they are expected to do a good job. I mean, that the system would not work if we didn't have public defenders. You could go back and try and change Gideon versus Wainwright, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, there's a lot of other ways to undercut it.
Yeah,
you know?
And some of it's insidious, sort of like our voter ID laws. You know, I was having this debate with somebody the other day, and he took the do you know who Glenn Grothman is? He's had a comment recently about what's the big deal about voter ID, and he said, "What's, you know, hey, when I go to the doctor, I got to show my ID. When I go to the airport, I got to show my ID." Well, you know, that's all well and good, except he has to understand that there were nearly 300,000 people that were registered voters this last April election that did not have acceptable government-issued photo ID that were either turned away or had to wait in very long lines. But here's the most insidious part of that that nobody really thought of until it happened. And I may have mentioned this to you, but when I went to go vote, they had it – I went very early, so it wasn't really a problem for me. But they had it set up where they were going to have the line that was going to be winding around the block, you know. And I asked, well, what's the deal? Why is it different this time? They're like, oh, we're expecting very long lines because of the voter ID requirement. So I asked the lady, well, what do you mean? She said, well, a lot of people will show up and it takes an extra, you know, they allocate, you know, what, 2.4 minutes per, you know, registration and a voter type thing. But you add another minute and a half to that time.
Is it that precise?
Well, they estimate how long it should take, and they're on a very – you know, they're trying to do it as quickly as they can, but they're also trying to affect the purpose of the law. So anyway, you add another so many minutes to this process.
It feels a lot longer for me because I'm looking at all these names going, who the hell are these people?
who's that? But then it also – you have to, there are a lot of people that show up and want to register on site. Then there's a separate line for that. And, you know, it ends up being something where the whole process ends up being extended. Now, here's the thing. Most polls, especially in a lot of the urban areas, they close at, you know, 8 o'clock. And, you know, if you're a working middle class person and you have to be at your 9-to-5 job – and I think your employer is supposed to allow you to leave to vote, but I don't know that they're supposed to give you 5 hours to leave and vote. You know what I'm saying? So I think that the complication of the process, making it more of a burdensome thing for people, discourages those people that are hourly workers.
Oh, it's obviously a political thing. I mean, this is
obviously it is, but
blatantly.
I just don't know if people Grossman isn't thinking about that part of it. The fact that it's making it more difficult, even for people that have the ID. That's what I'm saying. All the people that you know, you got to wait much longer. And some people will just say it's not worth it for me to wait that much longer because they don't see themselves as being invested in the political process because they're not big business owners with millions of dollars of tax breaks at stake. I mean, that person will wait in line for 5 hours. Well, but the guy that just wants to go
the argument's always been, hey, you know, we're trying to cut down on voter fraud. And I've yet to see a single person anywhere in this country to actually show me any evidence that voter fraud is rampant. There's like sketchy, like anecdotal, this case maybe once, you know, happens every 10 years or something. I mean, it's minuscule. It's almost non-existent. And so that's how you know that this is just 100% political. And they're trying to just discourage people from voting. And that is, frankly, un-American. That is un-American.
I'm sure you saw Grossman bragging about how you know, Hillary's probably got a decent chance, but thank God we have this voter ID law now because that'll help us defeat the Democrats. Hmm. I mean, he came right out and said that.
Well, you know what? Grossman does that. He just he has no filter. And you know what? I kind of respect that. He's just going to say what's on his mind.
The no filter litmus test.
The no filter, I'm just going to say what's on my mind sort of thing, you know, and
like Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, well, yes, I guess that's true.
So I found this interesting. I know we're going down a political vein here, but I just wanted to say this. You know, the Kentucky primary that was earlier this week. It was, you know, Trump is up against two people that are also on the ballot that just because they were registered for the primary, because at one point in the GOP race, they were viable candidates. But, you know, Ted Cruz and what's his name? Why can't I pronounce his name? The Ohio guy, Kucinich. Kasich. That's it. I've heard it pronounced so many different ways.
My brother lives there. That's how I know that. But yeah.
And Cruz were both, they appeared on the ballot, but they are not running campaigns. I mean, they have
suspended
their campaigns.
Yeah.
They're not spending any money. They're not doing any campaigning. They have no. You know, a vote spent on either one of those guys is a wasted vote. Nobody knows that. So under that set of circumstances, you would think the odds of being able to obtain 100% of the Republican vote at the primary would have been pretty good. But he got about 52%. So nearly half of Republican voters went and voted at the primary and didn't vote for Trump. I mean, that
who'd they vote for?
And he's the only, and he's the only one. They voted for Kasich and Cruz.
Really?
Because they appeared on the ballot, even though they're, you know, because they're still there because
wow, I did not know that. That's very interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, he claims a landslide victory against nobody, but it was a 52 to, you know,
he claims a lot of things that he just makes it up out of thin air. So it doesn't really matter if it's true. The truth is a very relative thing with Donald Trump. So speaking of the truth being a relevant thing, our erstwhile director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, has come out with kind of an astounding analysis of videotaping officers beating or killing unarmed black civilians. And I don't know if you have been following some of his explanations, and I use that term in air quotes, about, you know, how there's this Ferguson effect and the fact that police officers are now afraid to do their jobs, and there's this viral video effect that's made officers, you know, not want to confront suspects, and that's what's at the heart of an increase in crime in some places. He says, without any evidence whatsoever to back it up. Zero.
That's not new. That's what I've heard that a million times before.
No, I understand, but he's going on and on about it. And the interesting part is, and the New York Times had a entertaining, I should say, editorial about this subject, where they cited this law enforcement group called Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. It's a group of 165 police chiefs and prosecutors, and they denounced that. His viral video comment as unfounded and damaging to the efforts of law enforcement. And so
it's imaginary. And secondly, that's old school thought. That's what people used to say when we first started coming up with the idea of even having bodies.
And I'm really upset about this. And the reason I'm upset is because this is like the leading law enforcement dude in the United States. Right, he's like the head of the FBI. I mean, that's a very special position.
He's the top law enforcement officer in the country.
Correct. Right. So, if for him to come out with some of these, frankly, I think silly remarks, is really undermining, I think, not only the good police officers that are out there, but also just the concept, like the evidence-based concept of criminal justice that we're trying to switch to. And this is non-evidence based. This is no evidence whatsoever. Well, and that kind of upsets me in terms of like guys like us that are trying to improve the system using actual facts. And this is sort of almost a Donald Trumpish approach.
Well, hold that thought because we have to take a break. I'd like to respond a little bit to what you have to say.
Absolutely.
Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we're back. It's still Legal Defense, just like it's been this entire hour.
It's amazing. It hasn't changed one single bit.
With yours truly, Kirk O'Bear and John Birdsall joining me.
All right.
But we were talking about our director of the FBI.
Yep.
Yeah, top cop, that's right, who works for the Attorney General.
He does.
Indicating that there's a problem with the modern era of video footage and that it's actually discouraging law enforcement officers from doing their jobs properly.
And the pushback by law enforcement.
And law enforcement are disagreeing with that.
One of the things that surprised me about this mostly is that he's going on this rant about the Ferguson effect and the viral video effect and all this other nonsense, which has no basis in reality. But you know what? It surprised me because he, of all people, I'm going to say last year sometime, where he comes out and he talks about how there's unconscious bias, even for him, against black people. And I immediately gravitated towards him, and with great respect for, excuse me, for his ability to be that blatantly honest. And that, I don't know if you remember those remarks, but he was talking about how police officers are just, they're human beings, and they just are. And we all have unconscious bias. And if we just say we don't, I mean, that's just, we're just lying to ourselves. And when he even admitted that he himself had it, I was like, you know what? We all do. I do. You do. Everybody does. And so he was like radically honest about that. Probably one of the most important aspects of our criminal justice system is that racial bias. And then he comes out with this.
Yeah.
I'm,
but like
I'm,
I was
I'm
saying
perplexed.
Before the break, it's,
I'm perplexed.
This is something that I've been hearing for years from people that just aren't used to the concept. But you know what? When you go to the grocery store and there's the law that stops you from acting like a fool. But there's also your knowledge, your awareness that you're on camera. I mean, we got to get used to it. Everywhere you go, you're being monitored. And I think that when that was initially something that was happened, people may have been a little nervous about it. But those are the rules of our society now. You're on film, no matter what you're doing or where you're going. I mean, so if it's something that makes it so you're conscious of that and it modifies your behavior, maybe that's a good thing, you know, if you're talking about law enforcement behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the whole point, is that it provides a measure of accountability. And, of course, what I hear more often than that type of comment, and I hear this from law enforcement officers that believe in having the tools necessary to defend themselves against allegations of police abuse. I mean, don't you want to have that video there if you didn't beat the guy up so that you can prove it? I mean, it's worth its weight in gold if you're doing your job correctly. You've got the backup of some objective evidence. Now, the other thing that I've heard along these same lines is that a video depiction of an event, because of the limitations on you know, two-dimensional versus three-dimensional, that kind of thing. The limitations on what it's actually recording, the data that it's taking in. It can be misleading, but
it can.
I think we all like it.
Sometimes, that's true.
But on the other hand, it's always a valuable tool.
Oh, it's to hear what was said.
In most cases a fairly accurate depiction of what actually happened.
There's an excellent example of a debate over what a video purports to show, and that is, if you remember, Detective Rodolfo Gomez from the Milwaukee Police Department was actually charged with felony battery of a prisoner who he beat this guy. You probably remember this. The video was all over. So he beat this guy while was handcuffed in an interrogation room. And
yeah, I remember that. Yep.
He was actually charged with that, and and the amazing part is he was found not guilty.
I don't remember what happened with that. I remember seeing the video.
He brought in an expert. He had a very good lawyer, Mike Steinle, a friend of mine, and he brought in a nationally known expert on, like, police use of force, that sort of thing, and the jury bought it. The jury said not guilty. You know, and the explanation was, well, you know, it looks like he was hitting him, but it really wasn't, you know. And they were kind of like just brushed punches versus like full on, you know, that sort of thing.
It sounds kind of crazy, but I do know that it's a part of law enforcement training that sometimes in certain situations, I don't think that would be one of them, but certain situations, in order to get the circumstances under control, you know, you've seen it in police reports. I directed a series of controlled strikes to gain compliance from the suspect.
Yeah. I directed him towards the ground.
That's a fancy way of saying I started beating him up. But, you know, that is, you know, you might think of certain tools that people have in order to accomplish the job. The plumber's got his monkey wrench. The electrician has his, little splicing tools and things like that. Well, the cops have their fists sometimes, you know, in order to gain compliance. And that's part of law enforcement training in certain circumstances. But when that happens, it's always shocking, okay? And it's not what we don't have the lawful ability to exercise that force because we're not law enforcement officers. This is how the argument goes, you know what I'm saying? And when we, who are not used to being trained to utilize our hands as enforcement mechanisms, see something like that, it shocks someone who's not used to it. That's how the argument goes. You know, we citizens are not used to seeing what law enforcement people see every day. And I mean, it is kind of true.
I understand.
It is kind of true.
Yeah.
But I still think that any kind of resistance, you know, the FBI was the last, you know, significant organized law enforcement agency. I mean, I don't know if this is true if you look at some small town in Idaho, if they've gotten on board. But the FBI was very late getting on the bandwagon to agree to record interrogations. I mean,
true.
Wisconsin, yeah. Wisconsin had that codified, you know, mostly hot on the heels of the Avery wrongful conviction. And it took the federal government years to finally come to the conclusion.
You have to ask yourself, why is that?
We don't want
people to see what our agents are doing.
Well, I actually heard an explanation in – this was testified to in court – because I had a case where it was the classic, you know, defendant is saying one thing, FBI agent says something completely different, and the FBI, in that tug of war, well, the FBI agent's going to win, right? I mean, because with no proof counteract it. So, and that was one reason why, at least in our Wisconsin courts, you know, the Innocence Commission made a very strong recommendation in order to help prevent wrongful convictions, because it's well known that, you know, people's so-called confessions are a big part of the government's case. So just to make sure that there isn't any messing around with people's rights, we're going to make sure it's recorded. Well, the net consequence of all of that is that we find a lot of abuses of people's rights.
You know what it reminds me of? Reminds me of my cousin Vinny. If you remember the testimony of the cop who interviewed, I forgot the actor's name, but he interviewed one of the kids. He's like, and then he said, what did he say then? He said, well, I did it. And what he said,
I shot the clerk.
Yeah, or something like that. Right. But he actually said, he said it as a question. But when the cop testified, he said it as a statement. And,
all right, let me get to my thing here because we're running out of time. But this was in a federal case years ago. Before the FBI had changed their policy. And, you know, I was asking the agent on the stand, why is it that you don't record these things? Well, that's policy. I said, well, you know, do you have the option of recording if you want to? No, it's actually our policy not to. We don't want to set the precedent where we start recording these things because then people like you will start asking why. So then, you know, I'm starting to do a little bit of research, and I knew quite a few agents from back in the day when I was a prosecutor. So, you know, the explanation I heard that I think is, you know, widely accepted amongst, at least back then, federal law enforcement agents is that there are times when you have to violate someone's rights and you're not going to be able to use the confession because it's going to get tossed, but you don't want it documented that you violated someone's rights. And I'm like, that's not a very good reason. But anyway, hey. We're running out of time, so
okay. We
are going to regroup next week as we always do.
Pleasure
every
as always.
Saturday. Yeah, right here on 1330 WHBL and 101.5 FM. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear.